The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in American history. This hour, consumer advocate, lawyer, political activist, five-time presidential candidate, Ralph Nader. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In his new book, Ralph Nader provides what he says are 17 ambitious and common sense solutions to the nation's seemingly intractable economic and social problems. We'll also get his views on this election season and his take on President Obama's first term. And he'll tackle some of your questions. Ralph Nader, live in conversation after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is consumer advocate, lawyer, and political activist Ralph Nader. Now, some of you are old enough to remember when Nader first made headlines. That was back in 1965 with his book Unsafe at Any Speed. Remember the Corvair? Well, that led to congressional hearings and the passage of a series of automobile safety laws. Nader went on to build a national network of citizens groups that have had a significant impact in areas such as tax reform, nuclear energy, healthcare, safety programs. He's been named by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history. He's run for president five times, including that controversial 2000 election. He's the best-selling author of the latest title, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. Ralph Nader, what a pleasure. Welcome to River to River.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Before we get to talk about the solutions you have in this book you put forward, I wonder if we can talk for a few moments about the current state of our politics, since we are just days away from a general election, and you're speaking to Iowans.
Well, there's not enough choice for the voters because the two parties have been very successful in enacting state laws and other ways, keeping them off debates, third-party candidates. So what's interesting about the third-party candidates is they often advance positions and redirections that are supported by a majority of the people, and yet they can't get on the ballot or they can't get on the debates in order to give the voters more choice. The interesting thing that this book, 17 Solutions, imports is that most of these redirections are majoritarian-supported positions, and they're never discussed in the presidential debates in recent days or in the congressional debates. For example, a major crackdown on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse. There aren't enough prosecutors in the Justice Department, not enough investigators. People are being fleeced directly and indirectly of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. That's one of the solutions. We've got to have equality under law enforcement for the big guys. And the many other of the approaches in this book are common sense, but they challenge power. Like reducing our bloated military budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've talked to liberals and conservatives. They see the 60-minute reports. They read the papers. It's enormous corruption and waste in the military contracting system, redundancy, weapon systems that are obsolete because they were devised for the Soviet Union era of hostility. And yet the two presidential candidates can't get themselves to really discuss this in any significant way. And Romney wants even more military budget.
I understand your criticism about having the major parties only represented at the presidential debates, but given they are as they are, what have you found so far most interesting about those two presidential debates? Given the fact that voters have these means, 30-second ads, stump speeches, convention speeches, isn't this one of the best vehicles for getting to know positions and making candidates articulate positions?
Well, certainly for, you know, see if any of them have gaffes or how they emotionally react to one another. But they control the debate process. They control the number of debates. The reporters are chosen by them. The topics are given to them ahead of time. You know, there are very few surprises. That's why we're seeing a lot of repetition between debate two and debate one. They have their own, you know, set phrases that they use as they go around the country. So we're not getting that much new. And what's really amazing is that the reporters are not injecting issues that the two candidates have ignored, like keeping the minimum wage up to inflation. If you took 1968 minimum wage and adjusted it to today, it would be $10.50 per hour. What's the federal minimum wage? $7.25 per hour. There are 30 million workers in that gap. 30 million workers are making less than the workers made in 1968 when the economy and worker productivity was half of what it is today. You would think this is a great issue, at least for Obama. I can understand a private equity capital person like Romney not caring at all, but Obama has refused, even though we have asked him, we've talked to people in the White House, we've talked to top Democratic representatives in the House and Senate, and they're all waiting for Obama. Otherwise, they don't want to mention it. He's already given small business 18 tax breaks, and two-thirds of low-income workers are employed by 50 large corporations like Walmart and McDonald's. And this is a winning political issue, and it's off the table on the debates. And as well as many of these solutions in this book that have majority support, like full Medicare for all, they're off the table. That's my reaction when I watch the two men on the stage.
Ralph Nader is my guest, if you'd like to join our conversation. What do you hear that you like from Ralph Nader? What do you hear that you would perhaps like to challenge? 1-866-780-9100. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. You have run, did I get that right, five times for president, a write-in candidate in 1992 in the New Hampshire Democratic primary, a Green Party nominee, 96, and in that 2000, where it's still a controversial topic that whether you were a spoiler for Al Gore, and as an independent candidate in 2004 and 2008. Which of those times did you feel you came closest to igniting a real movement that would have elected you?
Well, I never expected that because the two parties have rigged the system. What we tried to do is give people more choice, keep a progressive agenda on the front burner around the country as it campaigned in 50 states and sometimes for the largest audiences in Madison Square Garden and elsewhere, getting young people trained in clean politics and as leaders of the future. And some of them have run for elective office already. The mayor of Richmond, California, for example, came out of the 2000 campaign. But I don't like the word spoiler if it's just applied to third-party candidates, because that indicates that somehow they're second-class citizens. Either we're all spoilers of one another if we have an equal right to run for election, all spoilers of one another trying to get votes from one another, or none of us are spoilers. And the press has got to clean up its language here. I'm not just focusing on your use. It was used on page one of the New York Times the other day. It's a politically bigoted word that should not be used applying to third parties, because they have an equal right to run for election.
Right. I didn't call you a spoiler. I said it was the controversy about you being a spoiler,
yeah.
Spoiler in 2000. Why didn't you run this year, Ralph?
Because, I've made my points. It's time for someone else to run. You know, we've won a lot of lawsuits against the two-party duopoly and discrimination against third parties, and we've gone into every state and given people a choice, and the voters aren't ready to vote for someone who they think can't win. And the system is rigged so that their perception of third parties that they can't win is right. Third parties can barely raise enough money to get signatures on the streets to get on the ballot, because the ballot access laws are so horrendously difficult, not so much in Iowa, but in some states, it's just outrageous. I mean, there isn't any Western country that obstructs voters and obstructs candidates from getting on the ballot if they're not two-party members as the U.S. And it's all state laws.
Ralph Nader, our guest. Let's go to the phones, if you don't mind, Mr. Nader. Bill is joining us in Iowa City, and I think he has a question, comment about a third-party candidate this year. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. You're on the air. Go ahead with Ralph Nader.
Yeah, I just wondered what Ralph's thoughts were on Ron Paul's candidacy. And I know Ron's philosophy is quite a bit different than Paul's traditionally, but in this case, times are kind of different, and it seemed like maybe there was, you know, to me it seemed like it was maybe one last hope for really saving the budget or something, or the way Paul was campaigning. campaigning. So I would just like to know what Ralph thought.
Well, there are convergences between Ron Paul and my positions, and I've spoken to Ron Paul about this. For example, we clearly disagree on federal health and safety regulation, on Social Security, on Medicare. But we have considerable agreement on military and foreign policy, the militarization of foreign policy, the wars and incursions and drones. He's very good on that. He's also very good at opposing corporate welfare. I oppose most corporate welfare is just very wasted, and it's unfair to small business who don't have that kind of power in Washington. We're talking about handouts, giveaways, subsidies, bailouts, you name it, the Wall Street bailout being most prominent. He's also very good on the Patriot Act. He wants, as I do, areas in the Patriot Act to be completely repealed. These are horrendous invasions of your home privacy, of your library cards, etc. And he's also good on these sovereignty-surrendering trade agreements. He's for free trade, but not to damage local, state, and national sovereignty to the degree that was done in the past. He doesn't like the tax. He wouldn't go for a Wall Street tax. But, there's enough convergence here to get something going politically in the future.
Okay. Bill, thank you for that question from Iowa City. Let's move over west to Des Moines. Paul is there. Hi, Paul. What question do you have for Ralph Nader?
I was wanting, first of all, I wanted to thank Mr. Nader for all his years of helping out people who don't have a voice. The other thing is, could you speak to, like, corporate profit margins now to what they were 40 or 50 years ago, especially considering the minimum wage? It seems like the argument against raising the minimum wage is, oh, that'll just raise prices, when, to me, I think you could raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour if corporations and shareholders are willing to take less profit. I'll hang up and just listen. Thanks.
Paul, thank you from Des Moines.
Well, here's what I wish President Obama would have said the other night. He would have said to Mr. Romney, Mr. Romney, you keep saying government doesn't create jobs. We haven't talked about big corporations' responsibility in this recession. What are they doing to create jobs in this country? They're sitting on $2 trillion of cash. They're reporting, these large corporations, record profits quarter after quarter in a recessionary economy with huge unemployment. That's pretty new. And they're not giving adequate dividends, many of them, to their shareholders. I mean, Intel just recently, Microsoft just recently gave dividends, but Cisco just recently. But, EMC and Google, there are a lot of companies that don't give adequate dividends, which would stimulate spending in the economy. And they're not investing this cash hoard. Yet they're paying the bosses enormous amounts of money, record boss compensation in the last few years and record profits. And Obama never did that. He should have said, look, I'm not the total czar of the economy. I'm not going to be responsible for this decline and that decline. I don't have the authority to do anything about it. This is a corporate-run economy. It's still a private enterprise economy. So, Governor Romney, what do you think big business should do in terms of a little corporate patriotism here, sitting on all this record profits and this cash hoard to stimulate the economy? Now, that would have been an obvious thing for Mr. Obama to do. Instead, what's happened is that the whole responsibility for the economy in its decline is on the president. Well, the president, first of all, has to deal with the Congress. He has to deal with the Federal Reserve. He doesn't control the Federal Reserve. He doesn't control the Republicans in Congress. He can't get a public works program underway. And yet Obama will never say that. He'll say, look, I can do what I can try to do, but why don't you take up, Mr. Romney, take it up with the Federal Reserve. Take it up with Wall Street.
Where is this? What is the basis of his hesitancy for doing what you just said?
The only conceivable basis is that he has to raise money from the same sources. The Democrats, as we speak, are trying to raise money in Manhattan and posh restaurants and all around the country from the business community. The other one is a little bizarre psychologically, that if he said what I suggested he should say, Romney come back and saying, oh, you're backing off. You're not taking responsibility. Well, in terms of the overall globe of power to affect this economy, the president probably has 20%. But only if the Congress will go with him to appropriate money to rebuild and repair public works in America. You know, the proverbial schools, highways, bridges, libraries, sewage and water systems, and public transit. And the Republicans have blocked them. And the Republicans in Congress are the allies of Mitt Romney, and he's not holding Romney accountable.
You have in your 17 Solutions book requiring national charters for corporations. How does that relate to what you just said?
Well, right now, giant corporations are chartered in little states like Nevada and Delaware, and it's a very permissive charter, and it does not require adequate accountability of the executives in these corporations, A, to their shareholders, who have virtually no power, their investors are powerless, B, to their employees, C, to their communities if there's a toxic pollution or a quick close down going to China without adequate notice. There isn't adequate disclosure to consumers about a lot of things. So I discovered years ago that President William Howard Taft and President Teddy Roosevelt were for what they called national charters for national corporations, or to take the chartering for these giant corporations away from Delaware and away from Nevada and other states and make it federal, so we can rewrite the compact with the people who, through their government representatives, give these authorities via the charter to the corporation. So, in other words, if you give someone a license, you can condition it. And Delaware doesn't condition its chartering. It just gives it out and gets revenue from the chartering business. We need national charters to put conditions, so these companies have to be more accountable, give their owners more rights, their investors, as well as their employers, the various stakeholders, employees, in a way that will help everybody. Mm-hmm. That's one of the redirections. And interesting that it started over 100 years ago, Ben.
Yeah, but this is one of your 17 solutions requiring national charters for corporations. But this and of many of these other solutions, we could say and be a skeptic and say, you know, these are all perhaps worthy goals, even if we agree with half of them or all of them. Where is the political will in the last case to have more regulations? We're in an anti-regulation mood. Let the corporations go. Let the businesses presumably create jobs.
Well, we're not in an anti-law and order mood. I think a lot of people are upset all over the country that almost no Wall Street crook was prosecuted and sent to jail for the crash in 2008-2009. That's one. The second is that one of the redirections is to create congressional watchdog groups in every congressional district. Nobody can stop voters from doing that. There are 650,000 men, women, and children in every congressional district. There are 435 congressional districts. And there's almost no civic organization for these general redirections, these general improvements that a majority of people want. Why? Well, we've gotten used to being a spectators of politics, spectators of elections, spectators of sports, you know, spectator society. We've got to turn around, look ourselves in the mirror, and say, look, the Constitution starts with we the people, not we the corporation. We're not asserting ourselves. We're not showing up in rallies and marches and city council meetings and courtrooms and not even showing up for mm-hmm. half the people, even elections. So I've got the way to start these congressional watchdog groups. Very practical. Nobody can stop people. First step, simple. You get 300 people in public auditoriums around the district. That'll get the representative and the senators to visit you personally in that room. In that room, you put your redirections for America and for your community on the table. And you have knowledgeable people in the room, so they can't slogan you. Up at the front of the room, the senator or representative. Once you do six or seven of these, then you get the names of all these people in these auditoriums, and you try to get them to mass training exercises so they learn how to be effective, powerful, resilient, no discouraging citizens vis-a-vis Congress. If you turn Congress around, you can turn the government around. Congress has the most power, the taxing power, the spending power, the war-making power, the confirmation power, the investigative power. So once you get these mass training seminars, it may be 10 hours over a period of weeks, You know, we have to train to learn how to use a computer or drive a car. Then you start interviewing people for the 1,000 hardcore Congress watchdogs who are willing to devote 200 hours volunteer a year and willing to raise a couple hundred dollars each to open up two offices in each district with full-time people. Then you connect them all over the country. Now, you know, some say, wow, that's a big deal. That's far less energy in hours and people than is exerted by that nice hobby called serious bird watching. I want serious Congress watching.
Okay. The 17 Solutions, your new book, we have about 3 minutes before we have to take a short break. In 2007, you published a book, The 17 Traditions, and those were 17 lessons in ethics and values that you recognized growing up in that small town in Connecticut where I presume you're right now in your office, Winsted, right?
No, we're in Washington right now, but it's a book on how my parents raised their four children in that small factory
right.
town.
And you grew up in the 30s and 40s in this small town in Connecticut. So when you talk about these solutions, are these things that we have lost that in your childhood you recognized in previous generations that we have lost in the last few decades?
Yes. I mean, one thing we've lost is our elaborating community economies. We're into chain stores. We're into giant corporations in our community. And I think that's reviving. Yes Magazine chronicles that. For example, we got more farmer-to-consumer markets. There's almost 7,000, and they're rapidly growing all over the country. That undermines the power of agribusiness when you put your dollars in farmer-to-consumer markets. The same if you put your dollars in credit unions and community banks. That weakens and undermines the power of Bank of America and Citigroup. And the same is true for renewable energy, wind power, local wind power, or community health clinics that emphasize prevention, nutrition, exercise. All this undermines the sales of these giant drug companies and hospital chains. Why is that good? Because it's self-reliant. It's no one in some financiers in London or New York are going to pull strings on you when you have local businesses like that. And it strengthens the family unit. It strengthens the civic culture. And above all, it's much more stable. It's not going to go into a crash due to speculation on Wall Street.
Okay, so it's encouraging that you see hopeful signs here in some of these areas.
And that's the way I grew up in that town. We had 10,000 people, Ben, in that town. And at one time, it had 100 factories and fabrication shops. You could hear the cows moo on the hill. And then a few hours later, you get in a glass bottle the milk. You knew where things came from. There were gardens. More people had gardens. By the way, gardens are making a comeback, in part due to Michelle Obama's work, but also in part to people want fresh fruits and vegetables, and they know where it comes from.
Ralph Nader, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. More a live conversation with Ralph Nader, his latest book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. What do you hear from Ralph Nader that you like? What would you like to challenge or find out more about? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. When we come back, more of your calls, your emails. Also, we want to ask Ralph Nader about the Occupy Wall Street ignition and then what, fizzle this year, 2012? We'll find out. Also, no surprise to hear that he's not a fan of George W. Bush or Mitt Romney. He's also not a big fan of President Obama. We'll find out why when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we are back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, the entire hour, we have consumer advocate, lawyer, political activist Ralph Nader joining us live by phone. And 17 Solutions, the title of his latest book, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. He's sharing these ideas. Also, talking a little bit about our current state of politics. And you're invited to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. We'll get to more listener input in just a moment before the break, though I mentioned that it's no surprise, Ralph Nader, you're no fan of George W. Bush. You were in an election against him twice. Mitt Romney also, not a surprise there. But you're also no big fan of President Obama. Why?
Well, I think, first of all, he has not fulfilled some very fundamental promises. He promised in 2008, right on his website, that he was going to go for a $9.50 minimum wage per hour, $9.50 by 2011. He promised that he would push in Congress for card check to make tens of millions of people easier to form trade unions and have collective bargaining, like in places like Walmart. He not only didn't lift a finger, he not only didn't say anything, he actually discouraged the AFL-CIO and some Democratic members of Congress from putting it forward. So I fault him for that. I also fault him because he has not used the bully pulpit domestically for reordering our public budgets. He really could have put a lot of heat under the Republicans for a massive public works program. Instead, he got very diverted with Iraq, Afghanistan, drones, all this. He fell right into the military-industrial complex agenda that President Eisenhower warned us about in his farewell address in 1961. And that took a lot of his time. I mean, if you look at the hours he spends in the White House with national security, figuring out what drones are going to kill what people, I mean, it's unseemly. He's doing it in an unconstitutional way. You know, you don't attack Libya without a declaration of war, without an authorization of funds, without an appropriation of funds, without a congressional war resolution. I mean, that's exactly what the Founding Fathers put the war declaration power in the Congress for. They didn't want another imperial presidency.
Right, right. But let me give you a little pushback as a devil's advocate.
Sure.
Here. Didn't 9/11 change everything? We saw there a very small group of people can, on the other side of the world, can reach us with deadly weapons, catastrophic consequences. Isn't keeping Americans and the homeland safe a president's very highest priority?
Of course, but both Bush and Obama did it in a way where they've expanded al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was only in Afghanistan. There are very few in Afghanistan now. We've paid a tremendous price for that goal, by the way, in deaths, injuries, blowing apart that country. So where is al-Qaeda now? Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. It's in Libya. It's in Somalia. It's in
Apparently
it's in
also,
Iraq. It's in Syria.
Apparently also in check with no attacks here on the homeland.
Yeah, well, the first thing is, we could have protected the homeland and the homeland, but what we did is we blew apart a lot of countries and a lot of areas, and now we've got these drones all over, and it's increasing the hatred against us, the willingness of young men to come out and fight. So we're banking a lot of revenge here. That's not the way to do it. Of course, we have to control our borders. We have to make sure that our air is secure, water, coastline. But what we did is we expanded the empire. And in so doing, we lost trillions of dollars over the years. We lost all kinds of casualties, not to mention a million Iraqis dead, the country blown apart, another dictatorship reemerging there, hating Americans everywhere in those areas. That's not smart. And Obama should have turned that around. I actually wrote him a letter before he was sworn in saying you just have a few weeks to put down different markers. Instead, he was Bush on steroids. I mean, George W. Bush probably can't believe that successor Barack Obama is actually more aggressive in more areas around the world, in more death-dealing instruments of destruction than even George W. Bush.
Ralph Nader, we have a lot of people who want to talk to you. Let's go back to our phones. Scott has been waiting in driving through Iowa, but Scott, I see on my screen you're actually from New York, aren't you?
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
I was just wondering if there is any practical way that, or realistic way that Mr. Nader sees for campaign reform.
Okay, thank you, Scott.
Yes, that's what a priority for these Congress watchdog groups would be. Now, we can either amend the Constitution and really do it fundamentally, and we all know how difficult that is with getting through Congress and then all the state legislators that have to ratify. The other way to do it is basically to allow a checkoff on the tax return, you know, the 1040 tax return. If you want to go up to $300 per person, put it in a trust fund, allocate it to ballot-qualified candidates, and give those candidates who accept the public system of finance, certain amount of free time on radio and TV. After all, the people own the airwaves. The FCC can condition licenses and say you have to give these ballot qualified candidates some free time on radio and TV. That's what I campaigned all over the country on in the various presidential campaigns. It's a nice thing because it's voluntary to the consumer to check off. It would be well promoted on the tax return by our government. And it would reduce the need to raise a lot of money just to put ads on TV and radio. That's about what we can do short of a constitutional amendment. There'll still be people who go for the billionaires or multimillionaires and the contributions. And unless we reverse Supreme Court decisions on that, we really will need a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. But this reform I'm proposing would go a long way in opening the doors to cleaner politics.
Ralph Nader, our guest for this hour, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future, the title of his latest book. John, on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, asks, who are you going to vote for in November, Ralph Nader?
Well, I've never said who I vote for. I just think it's a private matter. You can guess who I'm not going to vote for. There are third parties that are on the ballot. If you have a libertarian inclination, there's a presidential candidate, Green Party, Jill Stein, who, by the way, was arrested trying to go into the debate auditorium. They chained her to a bar for 8 hours the other night, Hofstra, at the presidential debate. There's Rocky Anderson. He got a late start, two-time elected mayor of Salt Lake City, worked with Romney on the Olympics, thinks he's a completely different person from the Romney he knew then. He's on some state ballots, and you can always write his name in. Rocky, he's the Justice Party. So I really favor more choices for the voters. That's what a competitive democracy is all about. Otherwise, you can't say it's a democracy when it's dominated by two parties dialing for the same commercial dollars.
17 solutions. Among those 17 solutions are a number of them. Getting corporations off of welfare, returning control of the public forum to the people. Much of this sounds like what the Occupy movement was trying to achieve last year. It ignited, but then, I guess, fizzled. Where is it now? What went wrong?
Well, their first act was very good. It was the encampments 24/7. It was the 1%, 99%, a great slogan. They basically put the issue of inequality on the mass media front burner. But then when they were evicted from these encampments, I think they were in Iowa as well.
Yes, they were.
They didn't
in several
have an
spots.
Act two, Ben. They didn't have an act, too. I recommend it, too.
And winter came.
Yeah, and winter, of course. But they could have overrode that. They could have suspended winter. And this spring, they could have gone for 30 million workers getting a minimum wage inflation-adjusted equal to 1968. That comes in at 70% or more support. They could have surrounded the congressional offices back home for the senators and representatives. They had the eye of the media, and they would have really taken a gigantic leap for progressive politics in this country. But, you know, they don't like organization. They're not good at it by their own admission. They don't particularly like leaders. That's not necessarily bad. But what I fault them is they didn't like leadership. And you just can't get. When you look at that farmer populist progressive movement that started in 1887 in America in East Texas and went all over two-thirds of the country, I mean, they didn't have dominant leaders, but they recognized leadership. And that's what they failed to do. So we're putting the 17 solutions on their table as well as on the table of the American people to see how much support for these solutions there are for liberals and conservatives, libertarians, progressives. We shouldn't be too impressed by the Washington politicians trying to say we're polarized. We may be polarized on social, religious issues, pro-choice, anti, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, those. But we are not polarized on the redirections that are described in this book. You ask people, you think we should tax first what we like the least or dislike the most before we tax your labor? And they'll say, yeah, what do you mean? Okay, well, why don't we have a pollution tax, well, a carbon tax? Even Exxon supports that. Why don't we tax a huge amount of revenue, the speculation on Wall Street with trillions of dollars of derivatives trading, computer-driven? Why don't we tax corporate crime? Why don't we tax addictive products that we want to reduce the use of? That's what we should do. Now, I think that would come in at 80-90%. Mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods, that comes in at 90%. We have a majoritarian citizenry controlled by a commercially minority-driven two-party duopoly. And that's why we're in trouble in this country. We're not putting the sovereignty of the people back. And the only way to do that is for people to rediscover their civic obligations, their willingness to show up at marches and demonstrations and city council meetings, their willingness to ask the impertinent questions of their politicians, their willingness to run for office, especially at local level, where sometimes they don't even have enough people running for the Board of Education, much less the city council. Participatory, initiatory democracy is the solution to so many of our problems.
Ralph Nader with us for a bit less than 10 minutes. Let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Nolan joins us from West Des Moines. Hi, Nolan.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, go ahead. We don't have that much time, but what's on your mind?
You were talking earlier about like corporate corruption, and we see things like obvious, massive donations from companies with obvious vested interests in candidates, things like that. Is there anything that someone as an average citizen can do to prevent things like this?
Well, I just mentioned that earlier. There was a caller, and I talked about a up to $300 checkoff on your tax return, voluntary, to go into trust fund, and free time on radio and TV for ballot-qualified candidates. But there's something else we can do. The more active we are, the more engaged, the more informed, the less big money affects us. I mean, why are we affected by all these hundreds of billions of dollars of television and radio ads? Because these radio and television ads are full of emotional, sloganized, often prejudicial material. And if we are not informed and we are not engaged, we're very vulnerable to those types of persuasions. So the more informed, the more engaged, the more we see politics is something we have to shape, the less effect big money will have to begin with.
Okay. This on our Facebook page, question for Ralph Nader. Aaron writes, I recall when I was in high school, many of my peers interested in politics often spoke enthusiastically about you. What do you think it is about your political positions that young people find so appealing? And do you believe your views still resonate with those young people once they have entered the adult world? They resonate with you, and you are, may I ask how old, Ralph Nader?
78.
78. Do you still appeal to young people? And why do adults?
Well, because I respect them, and I show them that as students, they're citizens now, not citizens in waiting. They can make an effect now. We help form public interest research groups among college students all over the country. They have their own full-time organizers, lawyers, scientists, people who are able to promote in their home state a better society. And we're trying to get into the middle school with civic skill courses, getting these students to have their teachers connect the classroom with their community. They learn about the history of the community. They learn about how the local economy operates, how the drinking water is purified, what's going on.
How do you sustain
so
that?
I respect them. I don't patronize them. I talk to a 12-year-old the way I would talk to a 40-year-old.
How do you sustain that activism, that idealism in that question from Aaron, too? Seems when we get adults to be adults, we lose that, and we say, okay, I'll instead of going out and being active politically in the community, I'll watch a few sitcoms.
Because the politics, it has demoralized us, and instead of roaring back and saying, look, we got a country full of problems we don't deserve and full of solutions we don't apply because they're on the shelf, we're going to make you politicians represent us or else, you know, you're retired. But if we're cynical because of what we see in Wall Street and Washington, then we withdraw. And that's exactly what the oligarchies and the plutocrats want. They want us to withdraw. They'll be pleased to fulfill the vacuum. If you don't hold your political representatives and your corporate bosses up to high expectations, if you keep signaling to them low expectations, they'll oblige you. The politicians know exactly how to meet your low expectations. And by the way, if you want an autographed copy of the scintillating paperback, 17 Solutions, all you got to do is visit 17solutions.com. Spell out 17solutions.com. You get an autographed copy. It's a great thing for civics courses, great thing for neighborhood meetings. I mean, this country can come alive fast if people only realize how easy it is to turn it around.
Ralph Nader, we have less than 5 minutes left. Let me ask you, over the decades of activism, way back into the early 60s, what achievement or achievements are you most proud of?
Well, obviously, the enormous increase in motor vehicle and highway safety. This saved over a million lives, millions of injuries diminished or prevented, and, of course, billions of dollars saved and a lot of family anguish. You might be interested to know, Ben, that my whole effort legislatively on motor vehicle safety standards set by the federal government started in Des Moines, Iowa, with an Attorney General, Larry Scalise, who held hearings on unsafe motor vehicles, and he summoned Detroit executives of the auto companies to testify, and I testified.
What year would that have been?
That was in 1966, and that got the eye of the New York Times reporter, who wrote an article in New York Times, and that got the attention of Senator Ribicoff, who had a key committee in the Senate, who said to his aides, "What in the world is this happening in Iowa? Why should we let Iowa do this? Let's get congressional hearings going." And 9 months after my book came out, we got the federal federal highway and motor vehicle safety laws through, signed by Lyndon Johnson in September 1996, and the rest is history. So you see, you can start it back home in the most unlikely ways.
Okay. We have in Iowa currently retention vote is among our our justices. They're put up for retention every so often. And I see that reforming the criminal and judicial systems is one of your solutions. Briefly, what is the thrust of that?
One is, if you're wrongfully injured or cheated, you should have your day in court. And these corporations should not get their politicians and legislatures to put roadblocks so you can't get your full day in court. They call it grotesquely tort reform. Like, imagine reforming something by taking away your rights when you're wrongfully injured by a hazardous product or a toxic chemical or a workplace condition. Second, we need to challenge these fine print contracts. We've lost our freedom of contract, and we just sign on a dotted line. And they take away our legal rights. They allow the sellers, whether it's the credit card companies or the banks or insurance companies, to unilaterally change the contract without our consent and put these fees and penalties on us. So this is something that requires public awareness and feedback, one consumer at a time. Basically saying, we are not going to stand for this.
Back to elections as we bookend this conversation. What would you say to those voters? And you said you didn't want to say, John, one of our listeners asked who you would vote for. You said you'd like to decline that answer. But what would you say to voters who do not vote this year, will not vote this year, because they don't like any of the candidates? And it doesn't seems that you don't like any of the candidates.
Bad decision. Always vote. If you don't like who is on the ballot, push for binding none of the above. And in the meantime, next month, you either can vote for a third party on the ballot, you can write in a vote, and you can, vote and make a vote of conscience. You want to always try to vote for someone you believe in or someone who may not be on the ballot, but you want to send a message. Because aren't we glad that a few people spun off from the Whig Party and the Democratic Party in 1840 and voted for the Liberty Party against slavery, or the women's right to vote little parties? So, you know, it's everything starts with one person. The farmer progressive movement started with a handful of farmers. The labor movement started with a handful of workers. So go and vote your conscience, but by all means, vote.
Sort of a personal question. In setting up this interview, I was told you have no cell phone. Is that true?
I have no cell phone. I don't use email because I want to get work done. I don't want to be flooded with stuff. We live in a society of trivial massification. I mean, just look at the politics. Look at the apps.
But your staff has email and cell phones.
Yeah,
Well, that allows you to do that then, right?
Yeah, of course. It's just like anything else. You know, if we want to take a bus, doesn't mean we have to own a bus or drive a bus.
Okay, very good. Ralph Nader, thank you very much for spending the hour with us. A few seconds to leave Iowans with another thought that you perhaps haven't gotten out yet.
Well, we just owe Iowans. They got me started. They don't really know that. They can get a lot of other things started from the heartland. And pick your choice. That's why I've written this book, 17 Solutions, because you can interact it at any particular era, even setting up a co-op or starting to run for politics at the local level. You can get a signed copy by going to 17solutions.com, spell out 17. Let's go, America.
Ralph Nader, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, well, remember just a few years ago, nobody knew what an app was. Today, many of us, well, maybe Ralph Nader still doesn't know what an app does. Of course he does. But what would we do without our favorite mobile software applications? Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with mobile app and tech developers across the state. We'll discover some newly created apps from developers right here in Iowa. Tomorrow, Friday, on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments, your questions about this program, suggestions. Contact us anytime, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.